This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We do more varieties and flavors of cheese than anywhere else on Earth. By pushing the boundaries of what cheese can and should be, find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to Processing, a podcast about the intersection of food and grief with your hosts, me, Zara Tangora, and my lovely mother, Bobby Conforto. Hello, everyone. It is the holiday season, as they say. And with that brings a melange, to say the least, of really complex feelings. Even if you like it, I still think it feels uncomfortable at times. I spent the holiday alone this year because of COVID. I do not have COVID, but I did not want to get COVID or spread it to anyone. So I had a very lonely holiday, and I kind of feel pretty heartbroken around the holidays. Anyway, I missed my dad. I missed being with my family. And as many of you, I'm sure, also feel, I really fucking miss regular life, so to speak. I miss being around people and not thinking about illness and viruses at all times. It's really hard. And it's really, I'm sure a lot of you feel this way. It's just really beginning to really feel like too much. So if you're feeling that way, you're not alone. And we just have to find ways to continue to get through. So anyway, I'm just on behalf of Bobby and I sending a lot of love to everyone. Always, but particularly during this time of year, which is just unforgiving at times and also lovely. And if you guys had a lovely holiday, that is wonderful because that also exists. So however you spent the holiday, we are thinking about you. And thank you for tuning in today. We have a great show. We are joined by journalist Tim Donnelly. Tim's a wonderful guy, and we had a really interesting conversation about, well, first and foremost, the passing of his father, and about change and about perspective. And it was just a really beautiful talk. And we were really lucky and honored to have Tim join us. And thank you, Tim, for your openness and sharing. And again, we're just sending love to everybody out there. And I think we probably won't get back to talk to y'all until after the new year. We're going to take a little hiatus. But please reach out if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Please rate, review, and subscribe to the show. I know that's one of those things that people say in podcast land, but it actually makes a really huge difference. It actually makes all the difference in terms of our show being able to grow and reach more people. So if you like us, please write a review or just leave a review or subscribe to the show. Tell a friend. Whatever feels good for you. But yes, thank you. Thank you for tuning in. We really appreciate you. And we really look forward to bringing this show back in January, better than ever. And hopefully full of new enthusiasm and life with more wonderful guests. So thank you so much. And take care of yourselves and each other. And we love you. Thank you. So hello, today we are joined by a new friend of ours, Tim Donnelly. Tim is a journalist and a New Yorker and an East Coaster, and it's a pleasure to have you. I see, as we're meeting, as we normally do via a Zoom-like platform, but I'm seeing that you have a gorgeous painting in the background of your home. I just want to compliment you on that, starting straight out of the gate.
Yeah, it's actually a photo of, you can't really see it with the Christmas decorations in the way, and no one can see it who's listening to this, but it's a photo of my girlfriend and our roommate on the roof last summer.
Oh, awesome.
There was a light leak on the photo, and it looks like their like auras are shining, and they liked it a lot and got it framed, printed out and framed.
Awesome. The colors behind you are just, it's a very nice image. Tim, you grew up in South Jersey, as you mentioned in your kind of pre-interview. I grew up in Long Island, as did Bobby. I feel like there's a lot of similarities to people who grow up kind of New York adjacent, but like in places that are just like close enough, but not quite the city. Did you feel that kind of growing up, that like, I'm like so close to New York, but yet so far away?
Yeah. You know, it's weird. I never felt that way. In fact, I felt very far from New York where we were, because we were very in a kind of like uncultured and a little bit conservative area in Ocean County, New Jersey. And we didn't actually go to New York City that often as a family or friends. I mean, we would every now and then, but it wasn't like we were popping in for shows and stuff all the time. And then I moved around a bunch. I went to college in Maryland. I worked at a newspaper in South Carolina for 4 years. And upon moving back to the tri-state area, was kind of shocked at how much like of a pass I got at being from New Jersey among like native New Yorkers.
Yeah.
People were just kind of like, oh, well, you get it. You get it, right? At least. Right. And, you know, in a city full of people who've transplanted from everywhere, from Ohio and California, people are maybe a little bit more like, well, at least you were in the stuff, you know, you get like what these people are like.
Exactly.
And I'm like, yeah, I guess so. I don't know.
Exactly. You say coffee the same way, even perhaps.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You say Super Mario instead of Super Mario.
Exactly. We're on the
same level. People hate that one, but he's from Brooklyn. That's how people in Brooklyn say it.
Exactly. 100%. So what was it like? What was like the family dynamic growing up down there? Do you say down the shore? Are you from down the shore? Now, as a New Yorker, I actually don't know the New Jersey lingo. We were from South Jersey.
We just say the beach.
Okay, so you're from the beach. Got it.
Saying down the shore or the shore has many negative connotations.
Oh, does it? I'm so sorry.
That existed even before there was an awful MTV show about it.
Oh, okay.
And we lived in a very kind of touristy area. We were 15-minute drive from the boardwalk, but I lived right near Seaside Heights, which is like a huge, you know, down the shore.
Right.
Like it's, I mean, that's the Jersey Shore, Jersey, you know, boardwalk,
right?
In the MTV show. So, we lived with like a summer of like being infiltrated by like people from Staten Island and North Jersey and Pennsylvania. And so we had like a lot of, what I thought was like maybe misplaced locals pride at the time, but now I realize was like probably, you know, accurate and healthy in that I have lived in a lot of other beach areas in my life, including Ocean City, Maryland and Hilton Head, South Carolina. And I could say a lot of bad things about New Jersey, but at least it's authentic. And at least it's like, you know, there's like real businesses there and they're like owned by families and maybe they're owned by the mob, but at least the mob is local, like, you know, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel the same way, Bobby. I don't know how you feel like being from Long Island. I feel like the similarities between the perception of Long Island and New Jersey are, you know, they're pretty similar. And, oh, you're from Long Island, a lot of like Joey Buttafuoco's or whatever it is, you know, that the stereotype is. But everyone, I really like wanted, I always like to honor that like everyone's hometown, even if it's like, objectively, like, you know, kind of like the shittiest place, or it feels awful, or it's oppressive, or it's whatever, it's still your hometown. There's still things about it that are like lovely, and there are things that you are used to, and there are things that are special to you, even if you thought they were in some way annoying growing up. Like, you know, I think it's important to just like, no matter where you're from, like, it doesn't matter. You can love it. I love Long Island. I have even considered getting a Long Island tattoo.
Whoa.
I mean, don't hold me to it, but I'm just saying.
I know I've seen lots of people with New Jersey tattoos, and I just assume that they lost a bet when they got that. I will say this. I have no real love for New Jersey, to be honest, and I do not want to go back there.
Yeah.
And even times I go there for a little bit of time, I often have something of a bad time.
Yeah.
And that people are just kind of mean in a way they aren't in New York, and mean and like territorial and aggressive in a way that like I think people associate with people from New York City, but is not the case in New York City.
Right.
People in New York City are too busy to be mean to you. They're, you know, no one's going to yell at you unless you're in their way.
That's true.
You know, unless you're blocking the top of the friggin' subway steps while checking your phone. But mostly people are nice and like happy to be friendly and, you know, to talk to strangers, which is a great part about living in New York in normal times, at least when you could freely go places. My family was kind of like a very prototypical like New Jersey suburban family, in that my parents were both from my dad was from the Bronx and my mom was from North Jersey, and they both kind of like decamped to the suburbs, you know, and started a family. And so they were kind of like people who pushed away from the city. Mm. And like, both my sister and I were a generation that like moved back to the city. She's in Philadelphia, I'm in New York, and, you know, love being that. So we had, we had a very small family situation. It was just like my mom, my dad, my sister and I mostly, and we had a very, very few grandparents around, or any extended family of any kind. So we kind of like lived a life like far from city centers and like far from the cultural footprint of that, which, you know, I'm not resentful for, but I wish we had like taken more advantage of it and been a little bit more, you know, participatory in, like the things that were available to us geographically. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, I actually always wonder about that when people have that kind of life growing up close to a big city where they kind of end up and like love being and thriving in, yet it wasn't part of what was going on at home. It wasn't being like, you know, it wasn't embraced by the family perhaps. Like, how did that kind of click for you? How did you become interested in the things you're interested in? Where did that kind of come from?
You know, it's interesting. This is like the great like justification of my life or great like victory of my life, is that I knew from a very early age that I was missing something. Back in even like maybe third grade, I was like, man, I really hate New Jersey. Like, and I didn't even know other places existed. I hadn't really been many other places. You know, we went to Disney World and it's not like I wanted to move there, but I was like, there must be something else. There must be something else going on. And I was just like, a lot of my youth was just being like truly terminally bored. And I think that's a lot of things that like most kids have trouble with, is like kids that get into trouble or violence or drugs, or, I mean, I was like not cool enough to be around drugs, but at least not then. but like just truly like looking for something to do and like, you know, being so excited when, my friends got cars, and like but there was nowhere to go when we had a car. We would just go to the beach, or we go to the mall, or we would just like drive around looking for something interesting. And so I always had this sense of like absence, like I'm missing something and I don't know what it is exactly. And I didn't even know it was like move to a city or move to New York, but I had a hunch it would be something like that. And so I almost went to NYU. I ended up going to GW in DC instead. And so I kind of like enjoyed being in the middle of like where there was stuff to do, but there wasn't really a lot to do. And so finally, when I was kind of like living in South Carolina, I had been working for this small but really good newspaper called the Island Packet, which is the big like newspaper on Hilton Head, and was owned by McClatchy at the time. I think it still is. And, you know, it was like a kind of traditional out of journalism school job. For anyone listening, I am a million years old, so I did go right into print journalism after college.
Oldest guest of all time.
Yeah.
So, Tim, when you were in South Carolina, your dad became ill. You talk about that a little bit? What was the circumstances of his illness? And I mean, I know in your pre-interview, you had mentioned that like throughout this illness, like it was difficult to understand the severity of it, which is something that I think, you know, I'd love if you could touch on that. Cause it is something I think a lot of people deal with, myself included, before my father died. You know, I mean, my dad was sick for 10 years and before he died, but like, we're not conditioned to necessarily be able to accept the gravity of these things sometimes. And I think we all think like things happen to other people, other people's dads die, other people's moms get sick. My dad will be fine. I mean, that's how I have thought, at least. And I kind of thought from what you were saying to us before the show, that maybe that was part of it for you. So can you just talk to us a little bit about your dad's illness, like what that was like for you, the experience of finding out, being far away, etc.?
Yeah. So I was, I guess I was about 2 or 3 years into my time in Hilton Head, and my dad had been dealing with a series of health problems that he was trying to get a diagnosis for, like, you know, had some weird pains in his legs, having trouble, like, you know, just kind of like achy in weird spots, and was kind of like, he was kind of an old school macho-ish guy who like hated going to the doctor and just like didn't think that doctors knew what was best for him. And so kind of getting to this diagnosis was a while coming. And then at some point he got diagnosed with a bone marrow thing that I didn't really understand what it was or how serious it was. And then it got upgraded to leukemia. And I was like, well, I know what that is. And it's weird when that happens and when you're far away and not going to the appointments and everything. You know, Hilton Head was like a 12-hour drive from them in New Jersey, I think. Maybe 10 or 12, maybe. It's been a while since I've had to do that. So, and like a couple, you know, obviously getting by plane was also, we weren't close to an airport, so that was my family in New Jersey wasn't close to an airport, so getting home was like not that easy either. But so it's kind of hard when someone gets diagnosed and you're not there and you're like, okay, I know this isn't necessarily fatal, so you just do what the doctors say, right? You just do everything that they tell you and like next step. And then all of a sudden it's like the steps, there have been many steps and there's been many chemotherapies and, you know, things aren't taking. And that was a little bit hard to just kind of get from far away because I was just hearing from my mom, you know, occasionally hearing from my dad. He like called me in the middle of the night, left a voicemail one time, like was having like horrible, like chemo nightmares or something. And I was like, oh, this is dark. But even then I was like, that's probably just a side effect. And then by time it had gotten like really, really bad, he got in a bone marrow transplant. We thought that would do it. And then that didn't take. And then it came back. And then it was like, okay, now things are really, really bad. So I remember coming up for, he died in August. And I came up in June to Jersey.
Oh, what year was this?
This would have been 2007.
Okay.
So I came up in June of 2007, for about maybe 5 days just to see everyone. And he was coming out of the hospital. And he didn't look good. He was weak. He was, you know, he had gone through waves where he actually came to visit me in South Carolina at one point when he was on a good wave and he looked good. He had lost a bunch of weight, but like not in a sickly way. And we had a good time. And then I came up to New Jersey in June and he was coming out of the hospital after whatever round of whatever treatment he was getting and went home to our family's house and just kind of like wasn't really there, like was kind of just like haunting the house, like too cold in one room, too hot in another room. Mm. Couldn't really watch anything on TV because he couldn't focus. And I was like, oh, this is dark, but I didn't know what to do. Mm. And I had to like at some point go back to South Carolina because I'm like, I know I'm going to have to come back up here because I know this is getting to the end. So at one point I was like, so I'm going to go and then I'll come back like when I could stay for longer, which is a really awkward thing. But I also had like a life and a job and I was covering like a town government. I was like the main town government reporter down in Hilton Head. So there was like I had actual like responsibilities that, you know, wasn't like I could just blow off this job entirely.
Horrible dilemma.
This is like long before.
Yeah, a horrible dilemma to be in.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like this is long before remote work was really a common thing. And so, I mean, you know, in retrospect, I should have just been like, screw it. Like, I'll just stay or whatever and spend more time. But, you know, you never know for sure. And so I was kind of just like, and you know, my parents were like both like a little bit, they were always a little bit weird with emotions and that kind of like a little bit maybe never really expressed them fully, not in a way that it wasn't like anyone felt unloved or anyone felt unappreciated, but just like talking about things, you know, airing things out, talking about your feelings was like not really done. So having them be like, no, you stay, you have a life, like you have things to do. In South Carolina. And I was like, yeah, but also I could, you know, I could put that stuff on hold. And so by the time I finally got up back into New Jersey in late August, when he was like on hospice, you know, he was like conscious for, you know, conscious and coherent for like maybe half a day when I was there. And then everything else was, you know, not, which was, I'm glad I got there for that at least, but it's rough.
Yeah, it's rough. And I'm just having this thought And it's something I've kind of pondered before, but I think sometimes, and it's kind of tying into what you were talking about, describing yourself in the beginning of this episode and like who you are and how you identify with being a New Yorker and how, you know, your New Jersey does not hold maybe a very special, like a, you know, fond place in your memory. I think that it's an interesting thing when we have a parent specifically who is dying in a town that we don't particularly want to go back to and spend time in. And it's not just about the pain of the parent dying. It's about you being like, and this can happen no matter where you have to go, because you do revert. There are so many kind of childhood memories that come up, but if you're going back to a place that you feel like you have moved beyond and your life is somehow taking new turns and you're doing new things, then you're called back to this, like, not only this painful feeling, but this place you don't want to be in. And this like memories of being this person you were as a kid that you finally escaped. It is like loaded. It's so loaded. And it's I mean, I just, it felt so palpable and kind of almost cinematic when you were describing that, especially having like gotten the backstory of how you felt about, you know, where you grew up in the first place. Mom, is that something
I'm sensing that you use the word darkness a few times, and it seems like it was like a kinesthetic darkness. You know, there's sometimes we go back to the family home, not just the family town, but the family home. And the minute you walk in the doors, there's some drag down. There's a pull down into old stuff, some stuff that wasn't processed. And now there was this new pain in the house. And I actually was at Hilton Head once, and I saw it as a very idyllic place. You know, there were dolphins jumping up in the air, and the ocean was everywhere. So there,
sounds amazing. Let's go right now.
There you were in this kind of new life, and in an island somewhere, an idyllic island somewhere. You know, and it must have been really hard to come home. I wonder what some of your feelings were at the time when your dad was on hospice. Then, what was it like for you?
It was tough. I have this theory that I will never be able to prove, because my mom has since sold that house and moved away. But that I was actually like truly physically allergic to the house that we grew up in. And I don't know if that was like entirely psychosomatic or, but like for years when I would go back to New Jersey, I would have like an allergic reaction of the kind that I like haven't had since I was a child, like, you know, like wheezing and like my eyes would like water and in ways that I'm like, I don't get these kind of reactions anymore. Like I've kind of grown out of some of my allergies even. But so I would go and just have these like crazy, like, I don't know if it was my brain being like, get the hell out of here. You don't like it here. But I would just go and have like kind of weird, you know, like reactions to just being in the house. And I was like, is there like black mold in here? Is there like a kind of tree we have in the yard that is making me miserable? And I never quite solved that mystery. So it'll be, you know, something I'll put in a novel one day, some maybe. But it was tough. You know, it's also tough seeing, you know, it was actually nice to reconnect with a lot of friends from high school who were there, who had kind of like never left our town. And so when I went home, when I went to the family house to see when my dad was on hospice, you know, there was a lot of downtime, obviously. So I was able to reconnect with some old friends who were still around and kind of see them. And you know, it's obviously a bit of a cliche that like seeing your friends who never left your hometown is like sometimes depressing. And this was like, I felt really good about it at that time, because I was like, this is nice to see these people. They're still here. It's nice whenever I pass through this area, I can like kind of see some folks that I, you know, were very important to me at one point in the life. And I don't like wish my decisions on anyone else. Whatever anyone has to do is obviously great, but I'm also like seeing folks that like are the kind of a version of what I could have been had I been forced to stay in town was just more reaffirming to me that I didn't want to be there. And then all your memories are wrapped around that thing too. So it's like when my dad actually passed away, like the moment he actually passed, I was not at home. I had to take a break. So I had gone to, I had use of someone's car in I think my mom or dad's car or something. And I had been home with my dad all day, you know, just kind of sitting by the hospice bed. And then at night, my sister and my mom came home from running errands. And I was like, I need to go out and get some air, just breathe. So I drove down to the boardwalk. I smoked a joint. And I was like standing on the boardwalk, you know, when my mom called and was like, it happened. And I'm like looking up at all these rides that like my dad used to take me on. And like our entire family history is like kind of connected to the boardwalk in some ways. Like we spent a lot of time there. I worked there for many years. My sister worked there for a lot of years. And you know, and we've just like, it's just kind of like a place you go when there's like nothing else to do. So like watching all this like kind of like telescope like back into itself and in one instant was like really heavy. And in a way, I'm glad that that was the case, because like it's nice to have all those memories, as crushing as they can be, piled on top of each other, coming down at you at once, rather than if they had moved to another state that I didn't have any feelings about, and it just all felt kind of antiseptic and you know, bland. I'm like, hit me, if you're gonna hit me with it, like hit me with it real. Don't just like hit me with the Hallmark version of it, you know. Like I want to get like really dig out those emotions and like let's go.
Well, it was like your whole life passing before you in a way, you know, as your dad passed.
Yeah. You see, I'm getting a little choked up. You see, you see the history. You remember like the early days, childhood, you know, all these times you spent together, you know, the rides you went on specifically. I have a very specific memory, and I've written about this before, is of just like my dad and I love the like, I don't know what they're called. They're like bumpy, they're like tall, bumpy slides where you go down in a burlap sack.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Like we love those. And they were so fun. I still go on those today. Yeah. Those are great. And I just have memories of us like doing that a lot. And I was just like thinking about that as I was like about to drive back to the house and like go deal with all this stuff after he passed. But
it's a really beautiful memory.
It's a beautiful memory. And you know, it's just when you're talking about being on the boardwalk when you found out that your dad passed, it's like kind of just such a interesting thing about how some things just stay the same and we change. And then when we see those things that were the same, you know what I mean? Like a building that's the same, a house that we grew up in, but we don't live there anymore. A place we used to work years ago, you know, a beach we always went to with our family, whatever it is, like, you know, a big tree in our old yard. And yet we have gone through so many different changes. And in some way, even talking about the folks from your hometown who didn't leave are similar to the boardwalk, you know, like it's weird when you see yourself, because we are all are present in our own lives and all constantly thinking about our own change and progress, and to witness the things that seem to stay fixed. And it's such an intense thing that I think people don't always talk about as much when we talk about grieving and losing someone, is the incredible sadness, not only of losing that person, but then the complications that come along with it in terms of like your memories. And in terms of like right now we're in the holiday season of thinking about things that like we want to think about again, but become so deeply complex, you know what I mean? Like wanting to go to the shore, wanting to go to the boardwalk and see, you know, the things and think about those memories. And then those same memories also being cutting and fucking devastating, you know what I mean?
The bittersweet.
There and present. And it's just, I don't know. It, when you lose someone, it like kind of ruins everything, but also like that has to, you have to find a way for that to also be okay.
That's the processing. That's the healing, is it goes from ruined to fixed, you know, to healed. I call what you're describing time traveling. Like I think we time travel a lot with our memories, and we can go back by just seeing. I love the image you said of the tree or that wonderful ride, the bumpy ride. You know, it's we time travel. And I think that's how we process things too, you know?
Yeah. And I, you know, the idea that you brought up about not changing and seeing that in relation to people who don't change is kind of a thing that that gets in my head a lot too, when I run into people that I used to know in New Jersey or in other parts of my life at any point, who have just kind of been stuck at the same spot. And I'm saying stuck, that's my phrase. They wouldn't see it as stuck, I'm sure. But right. It's like, you know, I know people who I went to high school with who do not listen to new music. Like they have never added new music to their rotation, and you will go to into their car or their house and they will play Stone Temple Pilots and The Offspring and Sublime. And like, nothing wrong with those bands, but like, you know, there's so much else to listen to in the past 30 years.
Yeah.
that I'm just like shocked that you would even cut yourself off from that. And the change thing is actually a thing that, you know, like probably motivates a lot of my life now, is that with my family, I feel like everyone kind of, my parents who I love and like were great to us, you know, they kind of like locked in place in a way that you did in the 80s and 90s when you were like doing the like parent thing. Like they both like, you know, like I said, they moved to the suburbs. They didn't develop a lot of like friendships outside the family. And my mom changed careers a bunch. My dad had the same career his entire life, which is working in men's clothing. And then, you know, my dad was kind of like forced to retire early. He was working at Men's Warehouse. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Men's Warehouse, for making my dad retire early. I don't know if you can name brand names on this.
Oh,
but
no, that's fine. They're a sponsor.
Forever hold that grudge on them. So he was kind of like, and he was only like in his mid-50s at the time. So he was kind of on a years-long quest to figure out what else to do with himself after he had left this job. And he kept being like, well, I need something that like, you know, uses my skills. And everyone he talked to was like, your skills are in retail because you've only ever worked retail. And he was like getting very, very frustrated by it and couldn't figure out what to do with his time. So he was just like mowing the lawn like five times a day and and watching everything on HBO. And, you know, I don't know what else he was doing. And like, you know, he went to like some job counselors. Like he was pretty proactive about it, which I was a little bit shocked about. But and only years later did it strike me that I what he should have gone into, and this will tie together nicely with the theme of the podcast, what he should have gone into is like restaurants, because he is like, he had the vibe of like really good restaurant manager. Like, you know, the kind that like comes to your table, checks and everything. Like if there's a problem, it will be their problem. Right. Like they will be the one to talk to the server and, or the back of the house. And like, you will not feel shitty in this restaurant because this guy is like there to take care of you and make sure your food is good. And like that, which, you know, many good restaurants have that kind of person.
Yeah.
A lot of good restaurants have the like, well, I don't, what do you want me to do about it? Kind of person, right, which is shitty. And my dad would have been like, he liked talking to people. He likes like hospitality in a way. And so I was like, God, I should have like told him to like go into restaurants or like find a, you know, I had friends, families who owned restaurants. I'm like, we could get you like a gig, like work in the front. And like, you would actually like really love this, I think.
It's a nice way to describe a father. It's a really,
it is. It's a very sweet way of painting a picture of him. How was he about food and cooking? Was your dad a good cook? What did you guys like? What are some of the food memories you guys have together?
He was an okay cook. He was kind of like a meat and potatoes kind of guy, but him and my mom had a deal where they're like, whoever came home first was the one to like make dinner. I mean, it was usually my mom who came home first because my dad usually worked like an hour away, but so whoever came home first would get dinner started. So he was like a London broil kind of like pork chops, you know, nothing like bad, just very like meat heavy.
Yeah.
When I stopped eating meat in college, he could not really understand it at all. Like it was just not very like, he just couldn't quite wrap his head around it.
Yeah.
So we did, you know, we did like cookouts in the backyard, trying to think of any specific recipes that he was like really good at. You know, he loved to like, he actually like loved going to the diner, which is a very Jersey thing, obviously, but
very
like
Long Island thing too. But, and tell me now, if anyone ever says they go to a diner, they're from Jersey or Long Island, first question, obviously, what's the go-to diner order for you? And what was your dad's?
Well, let's see. Our go-to diner was Sandcastle Diner, which is on Route 9 in Beechwood. What was the go-to order? That's a great question. It's been a long time. For a while, it was grilled cheese for me, but that was like after I stopped eating meat. I think my dad was like a club sandwich guy.
Oh, great.
I would get like a hearty soup, like a chowder or like a French onion.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all loved a French onion. I remember, I mean, it's Christmas time right now. I remember one Christmas we were there and just like on Christmas Eve, I think we went to the diner. And then on the way out, like the diner manager like handed us a free cheesecake, and that was just like,
that's amazing.
Like, sticks in my memory as like such a nice thing, even though it was like probably like not that big a deal.
It is a nice thing.
It just
sticks
in my memory as like, oh, these, they like recognize my family from coming here all the time, and we're like, have a cheesecake.
That's the power of restaurants, and I talk about it sometimes. But like, you know, I don't know. We sometimes just think of restaurants as a place to go in and out of, or as a diner as just being. that is a memory that like you are still like, this still significant. The little things that someone can do for you to make you just feel like appreciated. You don't get that often. You don't get to do that for people that often. Restaurants, I think, really have that kind of thing. And it's interesting that you talk about your dad, that he would have been good as a restaurant manager, because I think that is like a, it's a way of saying that he was like loving and thoughtful and like, I'll take care of it, which is huge. And it's a really incredible way to describe him. But yeah, there's those places growing up and they didn't have to be very good, or maybe they were, or maybe they weren't, or maybe they were just good to you and your family. But like, they're so significant. They are markers in time. I feel like life just kind of goes by very quickly, and a lot of it we forget. And for me, at least, I've always thought of places, of restaurants, of meals, of things like that, are these little trail markers where you can kind of like bring your memory back to be like, oh, right, that time we did that, because we like, we're eating this, it smelled like this, someone did that thing for us. Right. And it's like, for me, at least, because I don't have the greatest memory ever, it feels relieving to know that like there are some like little glimmers of hope of where I can remember, you know, remember things that happened in my own life.
Tim, you mentioned that you have vegetarian. Is that something about your life that has changed a lot, the way you eat?
Yeah. I am vegan now, and I've been vegan for 11 years. Mm-hmm. What year is this?
This is 20, yeah, for like 11, 30.
Yeah. So, and I gave up, I stopped eating, I went vegetarian in college in like my end of my freshman year, which is something I'd been kind of dabbling with, like, or thinking about in high school, and kind of had like, you know, I ran track and I was like, oh, I can't run track and be a vegetarian. That's insane. And then later on, I was like, no, that's not insane. That's normal. And so that was a big change in my life and made me feel better. And then when I went vegan, that made me feel like a lot better just about what I'm putting in my body and what impact I'm having on the world. And I just like feel better, like uplifted, whether it's from the food or just like from clear conscience. But, you know, our food at home was like, growing up, was not super adventurous. And I don't, you know, and I mean that in like, it was very like utilitarian, but like, you know, but good. And my mom like cooked most of the things and like obviously did her best and like, cannot complain about having a fridge full of food that I would eat most of when I came home from track practice on Fridays. But, you know, we had like, my mom's big food was like cornflake chicken, sweet and sour chicken, chicken cordon bleu, like stuff that was like fine, but not like hot, not, like adventurous. And one, there was a lot of chicken. And one year for Christmas, I think I got my mom a like, 1001 ways to cook chicken cookbook as kind of a joke, which I think was a little mean. But you know, they definitely like did their best. And like, you know, it was, we were very much like 80s, 90s, like consumer, all the ease, like at home ease, easy right. goods to make, like
of course.
Instant coffee, like, powdered, iced tea mix, mm-hmm. Lipton iced tea mix.
Same here.
Shake and bake.
I love Rice-A-Roni. Powdered iced tea mix. I used to like eat that out of, I remember being a little kid and like sneaking into the cabinet with the powdered iced tea and just like eating it with my finger.
Yeah.
It was a great pleasure.
I don't know why that was our family drink of choice. We always had a pitcher of Lipton iced tea in the fridge.
Same. We did too, for sure. It was definitely a very 90s thing. So Tim, also you mentioned that in 2020, or I guess that's last year, it feels like a decade ago, but that your grandmother passed away as well. And when you were mentioning...
That was this year, actually. That was
this year in 2021.
October.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, when you were mentioning this in your pre-interview, and to kind of tie it to talking about your veganism, you had mentioned that when you went home or went out west for her funeral... that your contributions were culinary and vegan, and that is something that's significant in you sharing with your family. And yeah, I thought it was interesting. Can you talk to us about that a little bit?
Yeah. So, just the quick background of what happened is that my grandmother, was 89, also averse to going to the doctor her entire life. And her and my mother moved to Arizona in 2012, my mother moved because she had started dating someone and they wanted to get a place out there. And my grandmother, she's like, well, I'm taking grandma with me because what's she going to do?
Sure.
So she's been living out there, having the time of her life. And then she got like kind of went to the doctor for something. They found a bunch of cancer in her. They were like, well, didn't know about this. And so she kind of like just went down really quickly. She was like too old to do chemo. You know, it was it seemed like everything kind of was kind of happening really quickly. So my girlfriend and I were in New Orleans, actually, at the time. We cut the trip in New Orleans short by a day, flew to Arizona just to be there. And my aunt came in from Sweden. My aunt lives in Sweden. My sister came in from Philly. And there was a lot to do there in terms of like talking to, you know, doctors and hospice and, you know, changing a diaper, which is not something I wanted to do. But just a lot of costs also, you know, it's expensive to die in this country as it is to do everything else. So my mom had to, you know, deal with those costs and just like listing things at the house at my grandma's house, like on, you know, on the free neighborhood message board for people to come by and buy. And, you know, that's something that I couldn't do either because I didn't know those people. But my girlfriend and I were like, we could cook. We will cook. Like, this can be our job. Don't worry. And no one worry about anything. Like, we'll take care of this. We'll go to the grocery store. And my girlfriend Callie and I have been dating for a year and a half as of today. Thank you. And she is she's an amazing cook and just like very competent and just like has a good instinct in the kitchen. And I am a decent cook and have also like gotten better, you know, over recent years and have gotten better since Callie and I have been together. And she isn't vegan, but we eat a lot of mostly vegan food at home, obviously. And so she's like taken it as a challenge to be like, what can I, you know, I'm going to like make all these amazing recipes that are vegan just in our home cooking. So when we went out there, we're like, we had a whole stock list of recipes that we were ready to make. And we're like, the family will love these. So, you know, it was simple things like a sheet pan, like sausage dish that we got from a New York Times recipe. It's like a sheet pan recipe where you put on some Beyond sausage, and it tastes like an Italian sub when it's all put together. Mm, it's yummy. Like radicchio and peppercini and chickpeas. And yum. You make like a tofu ricotta for the side and get a crusty bread. Oh, so good.
Awesome.
And we had like an enchiladas recipe. Oh, actually, we didn't make the enchiladas. We had a chili recipe. We had a couple other recipes. And we're like, we can do this because one, it gives us something to do.
Yeah.
Like when you're in the period of grieving and or waiting for someone to die and then grieving, there's just so much downtime. There's just truly nothing to do. You know, even like we couldn't spend time with grandma after a while because it's just she wasn't really conscious. So we're just like, okay, well, we can cooking like gives us something to do, makes us feel productive and makes everyone feel taken care of, because like I don't know what they were going to eat otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, my mom's fridge is full of like a million like Thousand Island dressings and like a bunch of tomatoes in plastic bags. Like so we're just like, we can make this like delicious food that I've learned how to make and that I know everyone will like, and we can make a lot of it. And it's just a nice way to like make everyone feel taken care of when there's so much other crap going on.
Absolutely.
While my mom and aunt are like changing grandma's like diaper and bedpan.
Yeah.
And
kind.
Yeah. And it's like, we'll feed everyone. My mom's boyfriend doesn't eat food. So I don't know what he wasn't eating anything, but he did try one thing, but he doesn't really like anything that isn't a plain hamburger, but
right.
We couldn't really do that. Couldn't accommodate that, but
yeah. Well, can't please everyone.
But yeah, it's just a nice, I don't know. It just makes you feel like productive and like you're taking care of people, and just that like, also like, you know, I love introducing our family to like better foods because my mom has gotten more adventurous with her cooking over the years, but you know, there's still a lot of like kind of the basics out there. So I think we're just like, hey, look at this easy stuff that we can do that's also vegan and that's delicious and like filling and all that.
Well, it's great to be able to share the things that feel important to you with people that you love and have them be received and then find that way. I think, you know, as we get older, we find ways of doing that that's more elegant. I can speak for myself, at least when I was younger and I had things that I was passionate about or that I thought about, I might have been more likely to, shove them down my family's throat and be like, this is the better way to do things. I, you know what I mean? Like, I've learned this. And there's something nice about becoming an adult and finessing the ways that we share the things we're passionate about with our loved ones. And it sounds like a really beautiful way to have been able to participate and care for your family. And like, those are one of the things that happen when there's a death in the family. And everybody needs to pitch in and we all find our place of like, I'm the cooking person. I'm the cleaning person. I'm the errands person. I'm the person, you know what I mean? We all kind of pick up the load where we can, if we can, and we try, because it's a project and it's something we all kind of need to get through together. And we're lucky, I think the luckiest, when there's a family full of people who can kind of make that work together. There's a lot of times, unfortunately, when that's not the case, but it sounds like your family did a beautiful job of that. And I'm sorry about your grandmother and your father. You know, I mean, these are just like, I kind of had this thought the other day about thinking about what grief is really like and how we're kind of conditioned to move past it and get over it and be done with it or put it in a better place. And in some way it's like as unchanging as your height. You know what I mean? Like once you kind of reach a certain height, this is it. This is the height you'll be. You know what I mean? You can stand on a ladder. Yeah. You can lay on your stomach. You can hide under the bed. But like that's kind of what it is from then on. And it's kind of like about finding maybe clothes that flatter you to, or finding people whose eyes you can stare into no matter where they're at, instead of trying to think that in some way it's going to change or you can saw your legs off to be different. You know what I mean? And I think that like, you know, we do it through finding things we're interested in and writing and the partners we find and the people we meet. And especially I think through like sharing it and being able to talk about it openly, because it helps other people, I think, understand that it's okay, that it's a part of you forever. And it is somewhat unchanging, you know, and you just find ways to dress for it.
Yeah. Find ways to dress for it is a good way to put it. I think that like, you know, I think that strikes me all that, and this is in no way an interesting or novel realization, but just like how much grief everyone gets in their life and how much just sadness built up, and you're totally unprepared for it. In that there's no way we could have better ways to talk about it and prepare people for it. And I'm glad this podcast exists and other things like it, is like just normalizing talking about these things, and that you have to be ready for it because it does not stop. Like you lose one family member and you think that's like the worst thing that can ever happen to you. And all of a sudden, a beloved teacher that you liked dies from cancer. A mentor that you had is gone suddenly. You know, people just start popping out of your life like at random times, and you're like, whoa, this just keeps happening.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you'll just get, they just kind of compound on each other. And you think about like how sad it is that anyone has to leave the party. And then everyone keeps leaving the party and you're like, no, why? We're having a good time. Why are you leaving? And there's just no way to really, we're just completely unprepared as people, and all the education we get, all the bullshit that we get, like they're just like emotional development and emotional maturity are just not really taught anywhere. And I think that's a shame. I mean, I don't know the right way to do it, but
schools.
I think just talking about these things and just being ready for the fact that you will have to deal with grief. It is truly the one constant in the world, and things will get sadder and cancer will come for everyone. And sometimes like David Bowie will die out of nowhere and you'll be like a mess for a month.
it's terrible. It's terrible. And I think just like, you know, this is terrible. And what else? You know what I mean? Like this moment was terrible. And also, look, the sun is shining and I hear a wind chime in the background and I can talk about it and I can eat a delicious sheet pan full of fabulous Beyond sausage and pickled pepperoncini. And that's delicious. And my grandma died and my dad died, but I love my girlfriend. And it's just this melange of different experiences. And it's, but I think really accepting that the ones that are hard always, right? Those are the constant. Those are the tree. That's the person in your town. They're never going to go away, but it's how you decide to kind of look up at them. and how to manage them in your life.
Yeah, and I think just learning how to sit in it and let it, don't fight it, and just be in it. You know, I heard something really nice, I think it was last week or the week before, from Andrew Garfield or something on, I think he was on Colbert talking about, I think his mother passed away when he was young, and he says something about, no, I'm getting choked up. Okay, talking about Spider-Man, let's go. So he talks about how, you know, grief is like the unexpressed love that you have. And that, like, you shouldn't run away from it because it's like a thing, you know, it's like it's an expression of a thing that you didn't get to say. So, like, don't fight it. Sit in it. Like, let it be. And it's not bad, you know?
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful way of putting it. It is. It absolutely is. And it's a continuing relationship. And it's something that I feel like we're told to just move past. And it's important for me, like, at least with my dad and, like, missing my dad, like, the connection I have around my grief, the times when I feel sad is, like, the times when I think about him. You know what I mean? I would never want that to be over. I would never want to be, if someone could say you'll never feel sad about your dad again, I would never trade that, because, like, what the fuck is that? You know, it's important, you know, and it's important to know that it's okay to feel bad too. And I think that's what we try to communicate with the show. And that's why I'm so grateful. Both of us are so grateful for you, for your time, for your vulnerability. It takes a lot. When we say this to folks all the time, it really takes a lot to come on and not only, like, bring up these memories, but in thinking about what you're going to say before, in the hour that we spend together, in the time it takes to kind of come down from bringing up all of this stuff and sharing it publicly, it's a big deal. So we're so grateful and we're so thankful for you and your super generous gift of sharing your story with us and our listeners, because it means a lot and it is very generous of you. So thank you so much, Tim.
Thanks, I'm happy to do it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. So we do ask everybody the same thing at the end of each episode, which is that if you had any advice for your younger self at the beginning of this experience, knowing what you know now about grief and about loss, do you have any advice for younger Tim about this whole thing?
I would say kind of what I just said, like, let yourself sit in the grief a little bit more. Don't run away from it. Spend more time with your family when they're all alive. Find the ways to, you know, appreciate them that are not the things that you ran away from. Even if that's, like, you know, going to a new location or cooking a new meal or, you know, different expressions of your, how you feel about them that aren't just being in the same room, you know, watching Lord of the Rings with commercials on TNT during Thanksgiving or whatever, because that can get really tiresome. And just in general, like, just do more. Like, I am not, like, a latecomer to the life is short philosophy. Like, I've kind of, like, understood that for a while, but, like, man, it really zips by. And so, that one got me, huh?
Yeah.
And so I think that's just, like, you know, and I've been good about this and I hope everyone is good about this. Like, do not, like, strive for a future where things are going to be right and you'll feel settled. Like, that's now, like, the time is now. Amen. And there, like, there might not be a future. Who knows when a pandemic will end? Who knows when the climate change will stop? Probably not. So, like, you really got to take advantage of things now. And I hope that we all, like, can live that truth, like, especially going forward out of this awful time in history.
Exactly. Embrace the moment. Beautiful. The other thing that we like to do on our show is that we like to think, if we could continue this lovely encounter and we could have a meal together, what would we all bring? So if we could have a feast now, we'd love to have some of your interesting cooking that you've been talking about.
Oh, well, I definitely, it sounds like you all are really interested in the sheet pan Italian sub dish.
Sounds amazing.
All right.
I would make that. I also have my girlfriend and I have a killer, my girlfriend and I have a killer vegan lobster roll recipe that we made a bunch this summer.
Ooh, what about jackfruit?
With hearts of palm.
Hearts of palm. Oh, that sounds so good. Oh my God, please share that. That's interesting. Wow. I love hearts of palm.
And I make a really good vegan eggplant rollentine where I use tofu.
Ooh.
And I do, and I whip up the tofu. I must admit, I add some locatelli cheese in there as well. But
we'll find a replacement.
Okay, and then lots of fresh parsley and a wonderful marinara sauce. So I'd bring some eggplant rolling tea with tofu.
Sounds so good, Mom. I'm going to round out this meal with caponata, but not eggplant caponata because you're making eggplant rollentine. So I'm going to do, since we're in the winter, like a squash caponata. So like sweet and sour. We have like olives and capers in there, sweet potatoes, like red onion, nice all baked together with some balsamic.
Yummy.
Sounds nice. Good. I mean, let's eat. Tim, I just wanted to all say before we get off, this episode was so interesting to me because it felt so much about change. You know, and I think that's just one thing that is important for everybody to remember when they're going through really anything in life, but especially after losing somebody, change. It's just like, just remember it, like keep it there from like the change of like who you are, you know, how you talked about from like growing up one way and having this like strong desire towards change and changing your life and through the changing of the, you know, seeing the changing of your life, standing in that moment on the boardwalk, through talking about changing your diet, like all these things. The episode is so heavily focusing for me, at least I feel like, about change. And it's special. It's important. It's an important message for people who are grieving and just people who are living, because it is always, you know, and even if you feel, I have someone in particular that I'm thinking about who's very close to me, who I know feels like their life is unchanging. You know what I mean? And some people feel like that, right? They're like, oh, nothing ever changes. This whole situation is the same. It's like, can't move. Like it does, you know, mm-hmm. Everything moves mm-hmm. and changes. And I think it's just important for people to remember. So that felt very powerful. Mm-hmm. The way you were able to speak about that. And just thank you for that.
Yeah. Change. And please listen to new music.
Yes. And listen to new music. Important.
There's new music out there. There's more to the world than Sublime.
That's true. Tim, this was really awesome. It was fun. It was funny. It was insightful, very tender and sweet and really raw. And I just thank you so much for joining us. It was a great episode.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you, Tim.
We'll talk to you later.
Take good care.
Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin, the state of cheese, makes half of the nation's specialty cheese and wins more awards than any other state or country. Our heritage and traditions, master cheesemaker program, and the American propensity for innovation all put Wisconsin on the cutting wedge of cheesemaking. With over 600 varieties of cheese to choose from and 5,500 national and international awards and counting, get ready to turn your refrigerator into a trophy case. Enjoying a Wisconsin cheese is basically like winning a gold medal in culinary achievement. Set your mind at cheese. When you bite into a wedge of Wisconsin Wonderful, you know it is made with the ultimate skill and passion possible. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com. Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.